Okay, good morning, class. We are in Bio 231, and it's the 23rd of October. And let's see, do I have the schedule up? Oh, I bet I didn't pull the schedule up just yet. Dang. Okay, let's go find the schedule, because I got to know what's happening in here. Okay. Okay, here's our schedule. Phew, had a hard time finding it. And so we said today's the 23rd. So let's find the 23rd. We're going to get into peripheral nervous system, finish up central nervous system today, which is 13, going to peripheral nervous system. All right, the next Monday we have a lecture, the next Monday we have a lecture, and the next Monday we have a lecture. But after that we have exam number 3. On November 13th. And look at this, November 11th, that's a Monday, we don't have school that day because it's a holiday. All right, so how far away is that? 23rd. So from next Monday, it's 1, 2, well, actually from today, because today's a Wednesday. Let's go from today. So 1, 2, 3 weeks from today is exam number 3. And you'll have a practicum way before then. Practicum is going to be in 2 weeks. Next practicum. Okay, anybody have a question on the schedule? Ooh, I forgot to read what chapters are on exam number 3. It's 12, which is fundamentals of nervous system, so you're done with muscle. So 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. 17 is the endocrine system. And the endocrine system, I don't have any modules. I don't have any weekly assignments for chapter 17. Right? But it's just in the study guide what you have to know and a lecture. All right, and then we just got a couple more chapters to the end of the semester after that. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have any questions on schedule or what we covered last time in class? I can't quite see, but I don't hear anything, so I think that's good. All right, so please relate everything that we're talking about to that diagram that I showed you at the very beginning of the nervous system, which what? Breaks down the nervous system into 2 main parts. What are the 2 main parts of the nervous system? Central versus peripheral, right? And peripheral we can break down into 2 more parts, sensory and motor. Okay, what's another name for sensory? Afferent. What's another name for motor? Efferent, okay. Furthermore, the efferent nervous system we can break down into 2 divisions, which are? We can break it down into 2 divisions, which are? I had to think a second. The autonomic nervous system, right, and somatic. Somatic means voluntary, sort of. What somatic really means is to some part of your body that's not contained in a cavity, right, that's a visceral part. So somatic nervous system goes to things like muscle, because those skeletal muscle, because they're not in body cavities. That's why we name it that way. All right, autonomic versus somatic. And furthermore, autonomic nervous system can be broken down into how many different divisions? 2. Which, and what are their names? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Good, so you should have that organization in your mind. And then we're going to get to all of those things pretty soon. But before we do, I think I do want to mention one thing about the autonomic nervous system, and that is the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. There's a special relationship between those 2 divisions of the autonomic nervous system that you should be aware of. And can anybody tell me in one word, what's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? Yeah, we haven't talked about it yet, so if you know, that's amazing, but you're right. Antagonism, right? They're antagonistic to each other. Okay, so we saw that in terms of the musculoskeletal system, how important that is. We'll see how that is important in the endocrine system as well as the nervous system as well. All right, so the slides are projecting pretty nicely. I didn't mean that to be a pun, but we're going to look at some projection fibers right now. All right, so we talked about white matter. This is the last topic that we talked about, white matter. So how many different kinds of matter are there in the central nervous system? How many kinds of matter? 2, that's right. And it does matter. because white matter is myelinated axons, right? These are tracts that are taking information long distances. You could think of these as being tables or wires taking information through a building, right? And gray matter is just unmyelinated nerve cell bodies and dendrites, all right? And that's really kind of the brain of the nervous system. That's where the network is established. And that's how neurons communicate with each other. Okay, so on this slide right here, I see a number of different things. I see cortical gray matter, right? So here we have nerve cell bodies and dendrites right on the surface of the cerebral cortex. And then I see white matter. Let's look over here first. Right, so I see some white matter going from left to right. I see some white matter that's going from superior to inferior. And these things we do have to know. This is a corpus callosum. Corpus callosum is that structure that can share information from the right cerebral hemisphere with the left. And indeed, that's a really nice thing when your right brain can communicate and let you know what your left brain is thinking. That doesn't happen in all people. And that's really unfortunate when that happens. You can have some really weird kinds of scenarios that develop. Because language, for instance, is on one side of your brain, mathematical ability is on the other side, and I could hold up a card with a number 1 and number 2 on it, and I would ask somebody, if they have a lesion in this corpus callosum right here, can you add those two numbers together? And they will say, yeah, sure, no problem. Then you see the numbers, oh yeah, number 1 and number 2. All right, so what's the answer? And they can't tell you, because their mathematical side of the brain can't get over to the language part of their brain to tell you. Even though they know internally, they just can't verbalize that information. Right? So really strange kind of things happen when communication between the right and left hemispheres is not happening. All right, so we're looking at this white matter. We said there are three different kinds of tracts. Remember, tract is just white matter in the central nervous system. A couple different kinds of tracts, three in particular. There are tracts that take information from right to left, right? And those are what we call commissural fibers. And so here, so the corpus callosum is what? A commissural area, sharing information from right to left. Right? Information also has to be shared from one gyrus of the brain to a neighboring gyrus, or maybe a couple gyri away, but they don't go to the opposite hemisphere. These are what we call association neurons. Right, so association fibers go from, they don't go from one side to the other because that's the job of a commissural tract. And then there are tracts that take information up and down, superior to inferior, like this internal capsule that we see between the basal nuclei. And this is taking motor information from the primary motor cortex in the brain down to the spinal cord through this internal capsule. And so this is what we call a projection pathway, taking information from superior to inferior, or vice versa. All right, so if there's a tract taking information from a superior part of the central nervous system to an inferior part, right, we call that a descending tract, and is that going to be afferent or efferent? That's going to be efferent. That's really nice. It's going to be a motor tract. It's taking signals out of the central nervous system. Right? If it's an ascending tract, taking information, for instance, from the spinal cord up to the brain, what kind of tract is that going to be? And your two choices are efferent or afferent. That's going to be afferent, right? So sensory and afferent or ascending tracts are all exactly the same thing. All right, so this is pretty important. I do want to point out to you that your book is not up to speed in terms of modern times in labeling ganglia and nuclei. So remember that list we talked about, nuclei and ganglia, or nucleus and ganglion for singular? Where do you find a ganglion? Or where do you find ganglia, plural? In the peripheral nervous system. And where do you find nuclei? In the central nervous system. They're really the same thing. They're gray matter, which means what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, just in different locations of the nervous system. But look what your book does. Right? This was valid years ago, not quite so valid anymore. Here we have the basal ganglia, the caudate, putamen, globus pallidus, right? That's the thalamus, but these four right here, these are now what we call, they're in the central nervous system, so would we want to call them basal ganglia? That's kind of a misnomer. By modern nomenclature, we would want to call these what? The basal nuclei. But still, many, many people call these the basal ganglia. So you're going to have to be aware that there's just a little bit of conflict with people that use a little bit of an archaic nomenclature. Okay, so don't be fooled by that. Okay, let's look at a projection fiber. We see fibers going through the internal capsule. That's this white matter between the basal nuclei. And it gets down into the medulla. And remember, that's in the brainstem. That's the first part of the brain, right after the spinal cord goes in through the foramen magnum. And I can see that there are tracks that cross over each other. Right, and they make these little triangles. And these triangles are right on the surface of the medulla, and we can see them. And when something crosses over from one side of the nervous system to the other, we say that it decussates over, right? So it decussates. And because it makes all these little triangles right there, it reminded somebody of a pyramid. It has these little pyramidal shapes because of all these little points right here. And that's where information crosses over. So this area is called decussation of the pyramids. And this is where information goes from one side of the brain to the other. In particular, okay, what kind of pathways are these? And if I look, I'll have to tell you what gyrus we're looking at here. We're looking at the precentral gyrus. Information is coming from the precentral gyrus, and they're descending through, that's another clue, through the internal capsule. Okay, so what kind of fibers are decussating over these making these pyramids right here? Yeah, descending, what's a better, more functional term for descending? Would be efferent, right? And in particular, motor pathways, right? Going through the medulla oblongata. So they cross over right here, which means that the right side of the brain is controlling the motor functions on what side of your body? The left side. And your left brain is controlling the right side, okay? And this is the reason why it is, because of we have this structure called decussation of the pyramids. Okay, so I think that's pretty good for right now regarding the brain. So let's get to the spinal cord. Talk about the spinal cord just a little bit. We'll finish some other things up after I get done with spinal cord. All right, so here we got a spinal cord. And these nerves that are coming off the spinal cord are what we call spinal nerves, and they have letter designation and number, right, because they correspond to the vertebrae, like C1, C2, C3, etc., etc. But let's take a look at the spinal cord and notice that, how about the width of the spinal cord? As we're looking from posterior to anterior, right, here I see the spinal cord. Is it the same width? If you look at this diagram, as you look up and down, does it look wider in some places and narrow in others? All right, I might have to zoom in, unless you have a picture of that. Can I move it back over like so? Okay, and you can see some areas, like right here in the thoracic region, is very narrow. Some regions in the lumbar region and cervical region are very thick. And that's because there are a lot of reflex activity. There's a lot of sharing of information and controlling various parts of your body here and here, but not so much in the thoracic region. All right, so what do you have about here and here, lumbar region, cervical region, that you need a lot more neurons for? Yes, very good. Right, so you have appendages, upper appendage. Right, so you have a lot more neural connections in the cervical enlargement to take care of reflexes for and control of your upper appendages. And the same thing for the lumbar enlargement. A lot more neurons are in this area for controlling reflexes and controlling motor activity of your lower appendages. That's why these enlargements are there. All right, the other thing, now that we've zoomed in, I can see something else. All right, and let me get this on the slide. The spinal cord kind of stops right at this level right here. Can you see that point of the spinal cord? That's the end of the spinal cord. That's about at the level of L2. And you all know what L stands for? Lumbar. Yeah, excellent. L2. And then through the vertebral canal, we no longer have a spinal cord below the level of L2. Right? We have now nerves. that are leaving the spinal cord. So the spinal cord can't grow as fast or as long as the vertebral column, right, during development. Nervous system grows very fast, but it still can't keep up with the length of the vertebral column. This tip right here, can you see, kind of makes a little point? That's what we call the conus medullaris, because it looks like a cone. It's a cone where? Deep inside the vertebral canal. That's what that means. And then all of these nerves together coming off the spinal cord, and they're going to exit, like, through what? L3, L4, L5, and then through the sacral foramina as well. All these nerves leaving right here. It reminded somebody of some anatomy in a different animal. And what kind of animal am I thinking about? And it's in this label right here, if you speak Latin. Okay, we see it's called the cauda equina. Cauda means tail, and equina means horse, or having to do with horses. Like an equestrian is what kind of person? Person that knows something about horses, right? Okay. All right, so that's the cauda equina. This is pretty interesting because there is fluid between the spinal cord and all of these bones that we see. And sometimes we need to get some of that fluid out to monitor the chemicals that are in the fluid that's surrounding the brain and spinal cord. And you know that's really important because your brain has to function just about every second in your life or things go really bad in your body. Right, because your central nervous system is controlling most things in your body through the autonomic nervous system. And there can even be infections in the brain that have to be diagnosed by looking at this fluid. This is called cerebrospinal fluid, right? Because here's the spinal cord. It's a fluid that surrounds the spinal cord and it's in other parts of the brain. So cerebral means brain. Spinal means that it comes from the spine region. And it's a fluid. And it has to be aspirated out. So what kind of tool would you use to aspirate some of this fluid, some of this cerebral spinal fluid that's surrounding the brain and spinal cord? You need a needle, right, and a syringe. And when we say aspirate, you just put a little negative pressure by pulling the plunger on that syringe out, and then that will draw up some of the fluid. So where do you think would be a good place to get some of that fluid? It's around your brain and your spinal cord, right? Would it be good, like, to drill a hole in somebody's head and get it out of there and suck it right out of the brain? Probably you could do that, but that would probably be like a $25,000 bill just to do that little, right? And it wouldn't be really comfortable either, so nobody does that, right? But we could also aspirate some fluid out from the thoracic region, right, by inserting a needle, right, through these intervertebral foramen, okay, right into this compartment right here. But if you do, in the thoracic region, poke a needle in here, what could you lacerate? The spinal cord, because the spinal cord is right there. So a better place is below the level of L2 because you no longer have what there? You no longer have a spinal cord. You just have these spinal nerves that are... You only have the cauda equina, right, which are these spinal nerves, before they exit through the more distal lumbar segments or sacral segments. So this is where we aspirate cerebral spinal fluid from. And commonly, you probably all know what that's called. I'm confused. I had it a second ago. That's called what? Oh, a spinal tap is a common name for that, right, where they just aspirate some of that fluid out. There's other names too. Okay. So that's the importance of knowing where this conus medullaris is. Every once in a while during development, the conus medullaris gets attached to the sacrum. And that means as the individual starts to grow, guess what happens to the spinal cord? It starts to get stretched out, right? And maybe even starts to rip apart. We call that a tethered cord. And that's really bad when that happens. So there'll be neuronal deficits that an individual might not be able to overcome any time in their life when that happens. All right, so that has to be diagnosed pretty easily, very early on. But nonetheless, even for normal people, the conus medullaris has to be anchored in a certain location because otherwise the spinal cord might start to retract up toward the brain. And again, that would be ripping these spinal nerves. So there is something that's very much like a ligament that goes from the conus medullaris down to the sacrum, And that is what we call the phylum terminale. The phylum terminale puts a little traction on the conus medullaris so that it doesn't snap back up to the brain, right? But it still allows the spinal cord to grow to its usual length. Okay, so that's some important things about the spinal cord, but we got a lot more really good pictures of the spinal cord. Okay, we can see that the spinal cord, we talked about this already, it has a number of bends associated with it. When we looked at the vertebral column with bones, right, we looked at these curvatures like the pelvic curvature, right, thoracic curvature, cervical curvature. You might want to just go back and review those a little bit. Here's a nice transverse section through a vertebrae and spinal cord. And what kind of vertebrae does this look like? What region are we looking at? Cervical. Ah, right on. Cool. Because of what? The transverse foramina. That's one nice dead giveaway. Also, the spinous process right here is what? Bifurcated. So that's really easy to see, right? Even if the lighting is really poor in class, but it's not. But if the lighting was poor, you could tell from way far away. So here is the spinal cord. And it's contained within a number of different coats or layers that we call the meninges. We're going to go over the meninges a couple times, but the meninges surround the brain and spinal cord, and here we're looking at the spinal cord. And I'm going to go over that in just a second, but what kind of impression do you get of the spinal cord? What do you see when you look at the spinal cord? It kind of jumps out at you. I see a letter H, right? And that letter H is made from gray matter, so that's nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And where is white matter? It's superficial in the spinal cord. Notice that the cerebrum has a different orientation. Gray matter is superficial, white matter is deep. In the spinal cord, it's the other way around. So this white matter right here, we have tracts that are ascending, which means what? Afferent tracts, and you have tracts that are descending, efferent tracts. We're going to learn two of those tracts, but generally it's probably not a bad idea to get a sense of where these tracts are located. So here I see a vertebral body, and is that anterior or posterior? This is really easy for you guys now, because here's the spinous process. So another way I could ask that question, spinous process is what, anterior or posterior? Okay, yeah, nobody would graduate from this class if you didn't know that, right? So here is posterior, here is anterior, and let's refer now to the spinal cord. Oh, okay, I remember what I was talking about. Okay, so we're talking about ascending and descending tracts, and there's white matter all around the spinal cord. And how are you going to know where these tracts are? And the way that these tracts are arranged, right, is loosely they're arranged by the function that we see in the cerebral cortex. Right, so where do you know within the cerebrum you have your motor areas? Where are the motor areas? Are they going to be posterior or anterior? Yeah, because we said, remember, one way to maybe remember that is, where do you have the motor in your car? The front part. So the frontal lobe is motor, which is anterior. So where would you guess that the descending tracts are? They're mostly in the anterior part of the spinal cord, which then means that the, all right, so that's what, descending or efferent. So that means that the sensory tracts are going to be more posterior in the spinal cord. So that's just one way to kind of get a sense of what's going on. That's not a rule that's obeyed 100% of the time, but that's pretty good. Spinal cord, once again, the layers. If you don't quite see them, it's probably okay for right now. There's a layer of connective tissue that lies on the surface of the brain and spinal cord and follows every little wrinkle or convolution on the surface of the brain and spinal cord. And it's a delicate connective tissue layer. We call that the pia mater. Right? And then the next more superficial one is called the arachnoid. And then the most superficial, and you can see it's the thickest layer, that's the strongest layer, the most durable layer, and that's called the dura mater, right? So all of these three layers right here make up the meninges. A little bit off the slide, but maybe I can bring it over, right? Meninges. And since it's around the spinal cord, right, then we call those the spinal meninges. Okay, oh, something else that's nice on this slide. All right, if I zoom in a little bit more. Okay, so I see the meninges protecting the spinal cord, right, and that's surrounded by cerebrospinal fluid, but there is a space that's outside the spinal cord and the meninges, and I can see some adipose tissue in there, and that's called the epidural space. What does epi mean, once again? On top of or outside of, right? So, and dural means what? The, like the dura mater, pia mater, the meninges. Epidural means a space right on top of the meninges. And that's a really good space to know about because sometimes you might want to block afferent signals coming from pain receptors going up to the brain. And remember, what's afferent again would be in this part of the spinal cord. And so sometimes anesthetics are injected into this space right here to block nerve impulses at this level of the spinal cord. So you can't feel anything below that level of the spinal cord. And what procedure is that used for? Many kinds of things, but commonly for? Yeah, for labor, right, for parturition. Okay, and that's called, what, an epidural. That's just kind of a slang nomenclature because where is that going into? The epidural space. All right, we're going to talk some more about these other spaces in just a little bit. Okay, the other thing I see on this slide, right, I see that there are two connections. Two neural connections to the spinal cord from this spinal nerve. Spinal nerve is peripheral nervous system, and spine is central nervous system. Right, these little gray things right here are just ligaments. These are not neurons connecting. So where we have neurons is right through here. This is a posterior, and then here is an anterior connection. We don't really use anterior and posterior in the spinal cord for some reason. We'd like to use ventral and dorsal instead. So here's a ventral region, here's a dorsal region, and these things coming out of the spinal cord, these are what we call roots. Right? So here is the dorsal root, here is the ventral root, and these roots kind of correspond to how information is transmitted through a neuron. And which way can you tell me information goes through a neuron? Can it go both ways or one way? It goes one way. And which way is that? Dendrite, cell body, down an axon, right? Not from an axon, oh, it depends if it's sensory or motor. Okay, but I was thinking of a multipolar neuron. But from what? Dendrite, cell body, down an axon. Okay, so a neuron transmits information one direction. The same thing for these roots right here. There's not bidirectional activity, it's unidirectional. All right, so what did we say was motor? In terms of the brain and orientation of the spinal cord, it's what? Anterior, right front, so or ventral. So this ventral root right here is for motor signals, signals leaving. This is the efferent way pathway for signals leaving the central nervous system. So the ventral root is always motor, and here's the dorsal root. And remember, we said that these neurons only go in one direction, so this is the afferent or sensory root. So roots are either motor or sensory. They're never combined. And that's because of the way neurons work together and the arrangement of tracts within the spinal cord. We see that the roots do join together. I see them joined together right here, right? And that's what we call now a spinal nerve. It's out of the central nervous system. It is now in the peripheral nervous system. And since it is a combination of both the ventral and dorsal root, what can you tell me about the activity of a nerve? How can it send signals? In one direction or two directions? And the answer is because it's a combination of the dorsal and ventral root, it's bidirectional. It has neurons from both of these roots. So some neurons are going this way, some are going the other way. All right, so we call that mixed. The function of a spinal nerve is that it's mixed, which means both sensory and motor. I see a little swelling, and this swelling is not in the central nervous system, it's in the peripheral nervous system, and it's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system? That's a ganglion, and indeed that's what this is right here. This is what we call, it's named after this root, and it is what, the dorsal root, and it's the dorsal root ganglion. And this is where the cell bodies are for all those sensory fibers that are bringing information into the central nervous system. And you should probably know what kind of nerve fiber by structure is sensory. Anybody remember what kind of neuron is a sensory neuron, the structure of it? You got three choices. Multipolar, bipolar, or unipolar, pseudo-unipolar. For sensory, it is pseudo-unipolar. And here's where the cell body is of that neuron. And then the central process comes over here into the central nervous system. And then the peripheral process comes over here out to the periphery. All right, so that's a lot about the spinal cord. We've got to know a few other little details. Okay. So here we have mixed signal in the spinal nerve, but I see a bifurcation. I see part of the nerve going which direction, posterior or anterior, where I have the cursor? Posterior, and then I have another part of that nerve that is moving anteriorly. And are these two nerves, in terms of diameter, do they look like they're the same size? No, they don't, right? So this one here, the posterior one, is a lot smaller. And the reason is because this is carrying information to all the parts of your body that are posterior to the spinal cord, which is what compared to the rest of your body? You don't have a lot back there, maybe a couple muscles, right? Right. And this one over here is really big because most of the volume of your body is what? Anterior to the spinal cord. So it's got to have more neurons. These things right here are not what we call roots. We call these, one of them is a ramus, both of them are what we call rami. Right? So here is the posterior ramus, here is the anterior ramus. All right, so you learned about roots, you learned about rami. What's the function of a root going to be? And the function of a root, so I'm going to put a cursor on a root, like here's a root, and here's a root, spinal root. What's the function of these things? They're going to be one or the other. They're either going to be sensory or motor, right? Like where I have the cursor right now, this is the motor root. Here is the sensory root, right? And remember, they join together to form a nerve, so what's the function of a ramus here and here? It's going to be mixed, right? It's going to be both sensory and motor because it gets axons from both roots right here. Okay, so spinal nerve is mixed, or the rami is mixed, but the roots are, they're not mixed. They're one or the other. All right, so this is a pretty nice slide that shows all of this stuff. All right, your notes also say what? Spinal cord extends from foramen magnum, we talked about that already, all the way down to L2. And then we got these two pathways in, dorsal root, ventral root. Talked about this stuff already, okay, and we just got to know a couple other little details of a spinal cord. Here's a nice exam figure, which pretty much shows everything that we've talked about so far with a little bit more detail, not too much more detail, but a little bit. Let's start superficially and work our way deeper, right? The first thing that we have to do before we can get into the central nervous system is go through the meninges, right? Go through the membrane system around the brain. And so here we see the three divisions of the meninges, one, two, and then there's another layer right on the surface of the spinal cord. Here's the big thick one, that's the dura mater, right? And then there's a little bit more delicate one, that's the middle one, that's the arachnoid, and then the most delicate one, which is the deepest, is the pia mater. So I see dura, arachnoid, and pia mater right here. And there's some cerebral spinal fluid between a couple of these layers, which we're going to look at in just a little bit. So we see the meninges. I see a root. In particular, what kind of root is this where I'm putting the cursor? I don't see a bump on this root at all. That is the ventral root right here. So this is anterior, where I have the cursor, and posterior then would be back over here. So here is the ventral root, and then this over here is the dorsal root, and the dorsal root you can always tell because it has that ganglion on it, dorsal root ganglion. So after you say that a couple times, that will just get burned into your memory to where you look for that little bulge to know if this is a dorsal or ventral root. Okay, I have a real idiotic way of memorizing the function of a dorsal root and ventral root. Does anybody want to know what it is? An easy way to memorize it? Okay. I'll tell you, as long as you don't tell anybody where you heard it from. Okay? But it's handy to me, at least my brain works this way. All right, so here's the dorsal root, and that is sensory. Well, we have a nice S in dorsal, right? And there's a nice S in sensory, right? And dorsal also doesn't have any T's. Neither does sensory. So if you go to this root over here, which root is this? This is the ventral root, a nice T in ventral. So what else has, what other word has a T in it? Motor, right? So that, so those things kind of pair up really easy for you to remember, right? If you get mixed up. If you can't tell what's anterior and posterior, just remember what? Anterior, because of the frontal lobe, is motor. That's a better way of understanding it. Okay. These little things that coalesce or anastomose to make a root, these are just what we call rootlets. And you don't have to know anything more about them. But these are what? The motor rootlets and the sensory rootlets are over here. Okay, because there's many more layers within the spinal cord than just, right, the divisions between the vertebrae. All right, so what else do we see? Gray matter. I see this point over here. I see another point over here and another point over here. These are what we call horns. So here is the ventral horn of the gray matter. Here's the dorsal horn. And then this is going to be the lateral horn. Right? We see lateral horns only in the thoracic region and maybe the first couple divisions of the lumbar division. When we get into autonomic nervous system, I'll probably tell you why that is. But here in the ventral horn, we have, what's in this area right here? You probably could tell me. There's going to be nerve cell bodies and dendrites or axons? Yeah, nerve cell bodies and dendrites of neurons right here. And what kind of neurons are these going to be? Efferent or afferent nerve cell bodies? These are going to be efferent because that's how they're arranged, because there is the ventral root, right? And furthermore, you could use that same logic to figure out what kind of neurons are in this dorsal root, okay? Well, they're going to be association neurons, right? I guess it doesn't work really well because here are where the nerve cell bodies and dendrites are the sensory nerves and the dorsal root ganglia, but association neurons have their nerve cell bodies over here in the dorsal horn. So you got these three horns. You got a pathway that can take information from one side of the spinal cord to the other. What kind of pathway did we call that, going from right to left without going up and down? That's a commissural pathway, and since it's gray, we call that the gray commissure. You find that in the spinal cord. There are no gray commissures in the brain. You have white commissures. And a good example of that would be the corpus callosum, for instance, in the brain. We got a couple big separations between the right and left side of the spinal cord. Anteriorly, we have the ventral median fissure. And posteriorly, we have the dorsal median sulcus. Usually a fissure is something that's more extensive than a sulcus. A sulcus certainly is a depression. But in my way of looking at the spinal cord, it's a little bit of a misnomer because this dorsal sulcus, I would have probably named fissure. And the ventral one, I probably would have called a sulcus. Right? So just remember that the dorsal one is a sulcus, but the anterior one is the fissure. Okay, what else on this diagram? Those are the layers of the meninges. Oh, we didn't talk about the white matter just yet. Okay, the white matter, we don't call these horns. We call it a column because it's carrying information either up and down. Another name for a column is a funiculus. And I should Google funiculus, but my guess is that it probably means column, some form of column. Here's the dorsal funiculus. And in general, what kind of information or what kind of tracts are in the dorsal funiculus? Sensory, right? Here is the lateral funiculus, and then here is the ventral funiculus. All right, so funiculus and or column, you could use those interchangeably. All right, the only last thing on this diagram is this little hole right smack in the middle of the spinal cord, and we call that the spinal canal. Where is it on here? Central canal. Okay, that's a central canal in the spinal cord. There is cerebral spinal fluid in the central canal as well. Right, cerebral spinal fluid here and cerebral spinal fluid underneath the arachnoid membrane. we'll have to piece that together for you, right? I think you'll be able to see how that is in just a second without memorizing all of that stuff. But this is a nice exam figure, which takes us all through this information on your word slide. Okay. All right. I don't want you to know a whole lot of tracts within the spinal cord, but I do want you to know two. Right, and here they are, the spinal thalamic tract and the cortical spinal tract. And the way that we name tracts in the spinal cord sometimes is by the direction of the signal, the origin of the signal, and where is the signal going to end up. Sort of like origin and insertion of a muscle, right? Some muscles have the origin in the first part of the word, insertion in the second part of their name. That's really handy. So what's a really hard muscle to know, but once you know how to read names because it has origin and insertion in it, makes knowing something about that muscle really easy. What's a intimidating name of a muscle, but once you know nomenclature, it's easy? Like sternocleidomastoid. Right, exactly right. Okay. When tracts are named, we like to name that tract by where the information is originating, and this is the first part of the name, and the second part is where it's going to. Right, like the spinal thalamic tract, and here's that O, which means what? We're combining two separate terms together. So where do these signals originate? Spinal cord. And where are they going to? The thalamus. Thalamus is in the brain. And remember that thalamus is that relay center for taking, now you know what kind of information. Information is going from the spinal cord to the brain, which is what? Efferent or afferent? It is afferent, it's sensory information, so the job of the thalamus is to take sensory information and direct it to the proper part of the cerebrum for your appreciation. Okay, so if the thalamus is directing nerve impulses to the occipital lobe, for instance, what kind of sense are you going to be aware of? Vision, yeah, that's the visual cortex. Okay, and if it takes it to the temporal lobe, what kind of sense will you appreciate? Yeah, hearing, right? The primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. For example, those two. All right, so spinal thalamic tract, right? And the second one right here, cortical spinal tract. Is this an afferent or efferent tract? Corticospinal. It starts where? In the cortex of the brain, right? And it ends up in the spinal cord, right? So that is a nice efferent pathway. Right, and these efferent pathways don't have to go through the thalamus. Right, they go through that internal capsule, they bypass the thalamus. So let's take a look and see where these tracts are. These are the only two that I want you to know. Where would you guess the spinal thalamic tract is? Spinothalamic, spine to thalamus. This is a sensory tract. Okay, yeah, dorsal. And then here is cortical spinal, that's motor. That should be what? Ventral or anterior part of the spinal cord. Let's see if that's true. Let's see if I picked a couple good ones. I don't know where this information is necessarily. All right, let me kind of just put this down here and let me find where some of these tracts are. Yeah, we're really close right here. What do we got right here? Spinal, cerebellar, dorsal. Okay, we're close. Ah, spinal thalamic tract, right? That's about as big as I want to blow this diagram up, right? Because I want you to see everything right here. So spinal thalamic tract is going to be what? Sensory or motor? Spinothalamic. Sensory, right? Or afferent. So this is taking information from the periphery up toward the brain. So here I see a little hand. Over here I see a little foot. And on this foot, I can't tell what we're doing to the hand, but on this foot, can you kind of see that? I see a match. So that means that we're branding the bottom of this guy's foot somehow or another. It's not commonly done in clinical practice. Okay, but so that is what? A damaging stimulus. So there are pain receptors on the plantar surface of this foot. And then this neuron is going to send information into the central nervous system. So here is what? A afferent neuron. And you can see here's the cell body in the dorsal root. So this is your typical, pseudo-unipolar neuron bringing into the central nervous system. And it's going to synapse on a second neuron. And this is an association neuron because it never leaves the spinal cord. And it's going to go up through the spinothalamic tract. Where is it going to end up? Spinothalamic. And the thalamus, look at that. Somebody drew this out really nice. So here's the thalamus, and I see it synapses on a third neuron, and these neurons go to the proper location within the cerebral cortex. Okay, and so this is going to be sensory, so this is your somatosensory region. Can anybody remember the gyrus that is somatosensory? Okay, if you've been studying a lot, you can remember, because we talked about it last time. It's right behind the central sulcus. So it is the post-central gyrus. And last time I showed you that little man that superimposes on that gyrus. We call that a homunculus. Right? So the signals from the foot, okay, decussate over, right? They cross over, and they're going to go to the foot region. And I'm not going to ask you to memorize what region is which. Okay? And I think the foot region is right about here. Right? Here's another damaging stimulus going to a hand instead of a foot. Here's that nice sensory neuron. Right, and so this one right here, since it's number one, we call this a first-order neuron. It synapses in, the dorsal horn. And then we have the second neuron going up to the thalamus, that's what we call a second-order neuron. And then the thalamus, there's another synapse, and that's going to take it to the proper location in that post-central gyrus, which corresponds to the hand, which is up over here. Right, so you got a first-order neuron, a second-order neuron, and a third-order neuron. It takes three neurons to get information from, for instance, a pain receptor in the periphery up to the proper location in your cerebral cortex. All right, and if we look at the spinal cord, we said spinal thalamic. Does this make sense? Spinal thalamic. It looks a little bit anterior right here. Okay. But it's a little bit lateral, all right? So, because we would like to say in the anterior part is what? Motor. And so that might be a little bit of an exception to a rule. Cortical. Oh, here's another cortical spinal tract. Okay. And here it is right here. That's certainly much more posterior. Cortical spinal tract. Here's the second one I wanted to talk about. So we're done talking about the spinal thalamic, cortical spinal. Information starts in the cortex, right? And it goes down to the spine. So let's start up over here. I see a nerve cell body. And it's going to go to a skeletal muscle. And so that's a somatic motor neuron in particular. And what is the primary somatomotor cortex in your brain? We said sensory was the post-central gyrus, right? For motor in the somatic regions of your body, which means basically skeletal muscle, where's that motor region at? It's the pre-central gyrus, right? So it's just right on either side of that central sulcus, right? So that's where that signal originates from, and it goes down through the medulla. Okay, and sometimes the signal crosses over where we have that decussation of the pyramids, and sometimes it doesn't just yet. So here is a nice motor tract in the anterior part of the spinal cord. So in this sense, right, that makes a lot, that's really nice. And then it decussates over through this gray commissure to the opposite side of the spinal cord to get to the spinal, to the skeletal muscle. All right, so how many neurons does it take? It takes one from the brain all the way through the medulla, down through the spinal cord, okay, to where it synapses, right? And here's that nerve cell body and dendrite of that somatic motor neuron, right, in the dorsal horn, and then here is the second motor neuron going to this effector organ. So it takes two. Sensory, it takes three. Okay, so those are the two pathways that I want you to, tracks that I want you to know something about, either ascending or descending. Reflexes. Wow, we talked a lot about reflexes already. And I kind of followed the scheme that's in your book, but it is deficient. All right, so here is a list of things that will make a reflex arc, right? And certainly this is the anatomy of a reflex arc, but in order to get this thing activated, what do you need? Think a little bit more functional, a little bit more physiology. What will activate this reflex arc or this response loop? The response loop always starts with a stimulus. That's right. And stimulus is not anatomy. It's just something that happens to your body, right? But what I would draw in here is number one, stimulus. And then all of this stuff right here is going to produce what? A response, right? So maybe draw that in on your notes. So if there's a stimulus, of course, in order to appreciate that stimulus, you need to have a receptor for it. If somebody does not have a retina for whatever reason, then they can't appreciate light because they don't have any photoreceptors in their body that are functional. Right? And then that information goes into the sensory neuron. You know the dorsal root is the sensory root. It goes past the dorsal root ganglia, then into the spinal cord via the dorsal root. It's going to synapse on an association neuron, right? And then that association neuron will send signals out through the ventral root, and is that going to be motor or sensory? Ventral is motor. Signals are leaving the spinal cord. Ah, and here's the motor neuron that's going to take it to an effector organ. All right, so we saw all that. And for the somatic nervous system, what kind of effector organ do you have for somatic nervous system? I'm asking you a lot of questions today. I know. Because I promised to get this tape on Blackboard for you to listen to again. Which is okay, yeah, online, which is okay because once you learn this stuff, right, and listen to the tape again, if I ask you a question, then, that's really nice if you know the answer before I say it on the tape, right? So what is an effector organ for the somatic motor system? Skeletal muscle only, right? And an autonomic or visceral would be a better way. What are the effector organs for a visceral or autonomic pathway? It's going to be, you got three. You got what? Cardiac, muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. Okay, those are the last three effectors. Okay, your book has a pretty good picture of these reflex arc. We've talked about it a lot, so I don't want to go over it too much. I prefer to go over the meninges, which we just talked about a little bit so far. Okay, but we do know that there are three layers and maybe some fluid between some of these different layers. Okay, so where do I want? Here's a really good exam figure. It's a nice cross section through the brain. Okay, here I can see the sagittal sulcus, right, or medial sagittal fissure in the brain. Okay. And so I see some gray matter right on the surface of the cortex and then white matter, which is deep. Remember, it's the opposite orientation compared to spinal cord. And we see some skin on the scalp, right? Some dermis, epidermis. And then we see a bone. And in particular, that kind of looks maybe like parietal bone, maybe a little bit of a frontal bone, but parietal bone, let's just say. Right? And there's a membrane that surrounds a bone. What kind of membrane is on the outside? The periosteum, and indeed, so here is that membrane right on the surface of the bone, right? So that's the periosteum, and then the internal surface of the bone has periosteum as well, right? Because only the inner parts of this bone have an endosteum, so you got periosteum on the superficial side and on the deep side. But now the periosteum, that's deep, starts to make something in common with another connective tissue layer, and that's called the dura mater. So the dura mater has these two components. It's got the periosteal division and the meningeal division. And because it has these two divisions right here, that's in part why it's the strongest layer of the meninges right here. So you got dura mater. The one in the middle is arachnoid. And one right on the surface of the brain is the pia mater. Sorry, my voice cracked and I might start coughing or something. So I'm going to have a drink while you look at that diagram. Yes, indeed it does. And it, which, matter. It also means matter. Okay. So, right on the surface of the brain, it follows every fissure and every sulcus and every gyrus, that's the pia mater. That's very delicate material. And then I see some fibers that connect it to the arachnoid membrane, the arachnoid matter. And but there's a big space, and we call that, since it's deep to the arachnoid, we call this the subarachnoid space. And the subarachnoid space contains cerebrospinal fluid, just like what we saw in the spinal cord. We'll learn a little bit more about that in just a second. So here is the arachnoid. There's not really much of a space between the arachnoid and the dura mater. Right? And the dura mater follows the major separations in the brain. This one right here that's separating the cerebral hemispheres, the right and left cerebral hemispheres, we call that the falx cerebri. That's within that longitudinal or sagittal fissure in the brain, longitudinal fissure. Right? And so nervous signals can't get across because that's just connective tissue. How can nerve signals move from the right to the left hemisphere? It's a commissural pathway, and you should have an example of one commissural pathway, and that is the, well, a structure, and it's called the corpus callosum. Corpus callosum is a, I don't see it on this diagram, but you'll see it a lot in lab and other parts of the nervous system when we talk about it. Okay, notice I see blood vessels, arteries, and veins on the surface of the brain, but I don't see any, right, deep inside the brain. Right? So most of these blood vessels, these large blood vessels, are superficial. So blood flows through the brain, and then it leaves the brain, and it's collected in this space right here. Right? And this is what we call a sinus. Here's a superior sagittal sinus that's going to collect blood from these major veins and then direct that blood eventually to a jugular vein, which returns it to the heart so that it can be pumped again. All right, so what else about this figure right here? Good exam figure. Oh, here's something else. That cerebral spinal fluid is produced by some special structures in the brain, right? And it's a combination of a capillary and ependymal cells that we looked at before produces that cerebral spinal fluid. But that cerebral spinal fluid should be returned to the circulatory system. Otherwise, you'll dehydrate. But something else that would happen is that if this compartment fills up with fluid, it's going to squeeze the brain. It's going to compress the brain. And then the brain won't function properly when that happens. So that cerebral spinal fluid should be returned to the circulatory system, and it is via this little granulation right here, which we call an arachnoid villus. So cerebral spinal fluid can rejoin the circulatory system at this point right here. So that cerebral spinal fluid system really is another circulatory system that surrounds the brain. Make sure that the brain gets the right nutrients and electrolytes like sodium and potassium and things like that. Okay, anybody have a question about this figure right here? All right, that's everything so far. Let's look at some of these connective tissues in the brain, like the falx cerebri, separating the right and left hemispheres. You have a really nice diagram in your book of these things. Okay, so here's that falx cerebri. This is a nice sagittal presentation. Okay, there's a falx cerebelli around. What part of the brain is in this region right here? That's the cerebellum, right, controlling motor function. So here's the falx cerebelli. There is some of that connective tissue between the cerebrum and the cerebellum, and it kind of forms like a roof over the cerebellum. We call that the tentorium cerebelli. Right, so these are really tough connective tissues. We used to get our brains for dissection in lab, which contained the meninges. I don't know if I have any left, but they're really difficult to dissect because what can you tell me about the dura mater? Really tough. It's like shoe leather. It's hard to deal with. It's hard to take off the brain without destroying the brain. Right, so now I order brains without that on there because it would take you maybe an hour just to get the brain out from underneath the dura mater. We don't have that much time in the lab. I'll try to find a brain with at least one brain with dura mater attached to it. Yeah, we're going to use sheep brains. Yeah, I have examples of human brains. Don't take the human brains out of the jar, though, okay? Because brains are really delicate tissue and probably just turn into pudding if you were to take it out. All right, so here's that crista galli of the ethmoid bone. Notice that it connects to the falx cerebri, and that's partially what holds your brain in place. That's why I like that ethmoid bone so much. Okay, the other thing that I see is that superior sagittal sinus, right, in that longitudinal fissure, returning blood down toward the heart. We're going to learn that here is a sinus collecting blood, and this sinus is between the cerebellum and the occipital lobe. Right, we call this the straight sinus. All right, and I think that's good for now. Okay, so we said, or I said, that cerebral spinal fluid is another kind of circulatory system. All right, but it's a circulatory system for what organs in particular? It's not a circulatory system for the lungs or for the heart. It's for brain and spinal cord, right? So it's fluid around the brain and spinal cord, and in particular, right, it's going to be going through that subarachnoid space, but it doesn't start there. It starts in some chambers inside the brain. So we have chambers inside the brain, and a chamber inside your body, sometimes it's called a cavity, sometimes a sinus, but in the brain and the heart, we call them ventricles, right? Chambers sometimes are called ventricles. So let's look at some of these ventricles inside the brain. I don't know where it is. Let me find where they are. So ventricles are inside the brain. Some really nice pictures. Dang. Ventricle. Ah, here they are. Okay. Let's look at these two pictures right here. I see a nice anterior view. All right, so here's frontal lobe, temporal lobe, parietal is about in this region. Spinal cord is right here. What part of the brain is just superior to the spinal cord? I see it. It's this first bulge. You're going to, that's the part of the brain, central nervous system. In particular, I want you to know that as medulla. That will come to you pretty easily in about a week or so. Medulla is that first bump, and the second bump is the pons. Right? It's the pons, not labeled on this diagram. Oh, maybe over here we can see it. The first bump is the medulla. The second bump right here is the pons. Make sure you know some functions of these two spaces in the brain. Okay, and then here are the lobes, and we can see the cerebellum. But that's really not what's important on this diagram. What is important are these lightly blue-colored areas. How did I do? Is that blue? Pretty close. Okay. So these are empty spaces inside the brain. Okay, but they're really not quite empty because they don't contain neurons, but they contain cerebrospinal fluid in particular. This used to be called number one and number two ventricles, but now we've combined them and talk about them a little bit differently. There's an anterior horn, right, and an interior horn. We put all those together. We call these the lateral ventricles because why? They are far away from midline, right? They're not on midline. They're off midline, so they're lateral. These are the lateral ventricles, and then here is a communication between the lateral ventricles and this one here, and this is the third one, right, because lateral was one and two, so here's third, and here's a hole connecting these two sets of ventricles. What do we call a hole once again? A foramen, right, so here's the interventricular foramen in the brain, right, because it's between the lateral and third ventricle. And then I see another ventricle down here between the pons and the cerebellum, right, at the fourth ventricle, and it's connected to the third, right? But this is a longer kind of canal, so we call this the cerebral aqueduct. Somebody named it an aqueduct, or the aqueduct of Sylvius way before we would call it a foramen. So fluid flows through all of these structures, right, and then down through the central canal of the spinal cord. It might leave through this lateral aperture here and here. There's even a median aperture in the back of the fourth ventricle. All right, so let's go over these ventricles once again from a lateral view. Here are the lateral ventricles. Right, here's that interventricular foramen. Fluid flows into the third ventricle. Kind of looks like a donut because here is some connection between the right and left lobes of the thalamus, so the thalamus would be about in this region. And then on either side, in the walls of this third ventricle here and here, what part of the brain would be here? So let me see, where is it over here? What part of the brain is going to be in this region here and here, which is here and here? If this is thalamus, this is hypothalamus. Yeah, that's the hypothalamus, and then pituitary gland would be right in this region. All right, so here is the third ventricle. Then it goes through the aqueduct of Sylvius into the fourth ventricle, and then down through the central canal, goes all the way down to the conus medullaris, where it goes and leaks into the subarachnoid space and the spinal cord, and then it flows all the way back up to the brain. And we have a nice picture to show that. This is just the anatomy of the ventricles and the central canal of the spinal cord. So in lab, this is definitely an important set of structures to know. And it might be one of my favorite models in lab, this one right here, of the ventricles, the ventricular system of the brain. Okay, so what do we have inside these ventricles and the central canal? What do we have in there once again? Yeah, and probably you would want to say cerebrospinal fluid because it's in the cerebrum, right? It's in the cerebrum and spinal cord, cerebrospinal fluid. And where does it come from? It comes from the blood, right? And in particular, there's a structure that's part capillary, which is part of your vascular system, and ependymal cells. Maybe you have to go back and look what an ependymal cell looks like. Right? Those things come together, and that is called a choroid plexus. So what does a choroid plexus look like? It looks like this thing right here. Remember these ependymal cells? They line the ventricles, we said. Now you have a picture of where the ventricles are in the brain. Too bad you can't learn all of this in like 10 seconds. It would make a whole lot more sense if you could learn everything at one time, but you just can't do that, right? So then you got to go back and look at these types of cells within the nervous system. This is what a support cell or neuroglia cell. Here's that capillary where fluid comes from. It works with these ependymal cells to make cerebrospinal fluid, which is mostly water, but it contains glucose. It's an important energy molecule. Oxygen, necessary to keep those nerve cells alive. Vitamins and some ions like sodium and chloride, magnesium. Okay, and it can also remove waste products from the cerebrospinal fluid as well. So that is, right, choroid plexus, choroid plexus. There's choroid plexus in the lateral ventricles. There's choroid plexus in the third ventricle, and there's choroid plexus in the fourth ventricle. So cerebrospinal fluid is made in each of those areas. All right, so now we can go look at this thing right here. Nice sagittal section. So we're looking right into that longitudinal fissure between the hemispheres. Laterally, we have the lateral ventricles, and here is some choroid plexus. It looks like a bunch of little worms to me. Right, making cerebrospinal fluid that flows into the lateral ventricles. And then that fluid is going to flow through that interventricular frame and into the third ventricle. And on the roof of the third ventricle, you got more choroid plexus. What is this choroid plexus going to make? Cerebrospinal fluid, more. And then it's going to move down through this cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle. Oh, and I see what? More choroid plexus making cerebrospinal fluid, and it can leave at this area right here through the median aperture into this subarachnoid space, or it can go down the central canal of the spinal cord, down to the conus medullaris, makes its way back up, okay, into this sagittal sinus, and here's a nice arachnoid villus or granulation that returns that cerebrospinal fluid back to the circulatory system, so that we don't dehydrate, and especially so the brain doesn't fill up with fluid, right? Because if it fills up with fluid, then you can't have a brain there. And it's much better to have a brain in the cranium than just what? Fluid. All right, so these arrows depict the flow of fluid through the ventricular system of the brain. And there's something else. This fluid is very pulsatile, right? It flows with the beating of your heart, because every time your heart contracts, it pushes up a huge volume of blood into the brain because it needs all that oxygen, right? And the cranium. What can you tell me about the bones that make the cranium? Can the cranium expand and contract? Only in science fiction movies, right? When somebody's communicating, does the head kind of go like that. But our heads can't expand and contract. Our cranium is the same size. So when a big volume of blood is squirted up into the brain by the heart, right? there's something that has to squirt back down out of the cranium, and that is cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so the volume of the nervous tissue doesn't change, but the volume of blood and cerebrospinal fluid does change. As blood flows in, cerebrospinal fluid has to flow out. Right, so every time the heart beats, you see a little pulsatile motion through this aqueduct down into the spinal cord. And so that's really what moves the cerebrospinal fluid around. What else do I want to say about cerebrospinal fluid? I think that's pretty much it. Other than, oh, your notes say, what, the total volume is about 150 mLs, but you make about half a liter a day of cerebrospinal fluid. Now, if this circulatory system, okay, is plugged up, then cerebrospinal fluid is being made by the choroid plexus, but it can't get back to the circulatory system. What happens? Something really bad happens. Okay? So here is an infant with probably the aqueductus sylvius or maybe that interventricular foramen plugged up. And when a vessel or a foramen is plugged up, we say it's not patent. If it's open, we say it is patent. So those communications are not patent, and cerebrospinal fluid has collected right within the cranium of this individual, and that this individual won't live for very long as a result of that. Right? You can never recover from that kind of injury. Fortunately today, what do? With good prenatal care? A very easy imaging technique. What do we use? Some of you have had this, I'm sure. Ultrasound. Right? With ultrasound, it's very easy to diagnose this condition early on before it produces neuronal deficits in a person. Right? And the reason why I mention it is because that surgery, okay, to correct those chambers inside the brain can be done in utero, right, before delivery. Right? So I find that pretty amazing. So what happens when somebody has that kind of surgery? A shunt is placed maybe within a ventricle, and then it's directed directly into a vein someplace in the head. Or maybe it's directed to a subclavian vein. Where's the subclavian vein? Haven't looked at veins yet, but underneath the clavicle, right? And then that helps reduce the pressure in the brain, and then that individual's brain can develop normally after that. That's pretty cool, right? That we can do, not we, somebody can do surgery prenatally like that. Well, guess what? We didn't get into peripheral nervous system today, but we're done with central nervous system. I guess I got carried away, but it's an important part of our anatomy, right? So spend some extra time with the central nervous system. Okay, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today. Dorsal root and...